they're right. That is to say, Dawkins, Hitchens, Harris, and the other new atheists are right about some of what they say. Well, I'll turn to that thought in a few moments, but what I'd like to do to begin with is to provide you with just a very brief overview of the history of atheism. I'm going to use the expression the new atheism, and as you can see, it's on the screen behind me. But really, atheism, as we see it today, isn't new. In fact, most of the arguments aren't new. They go back hundreds of years. In fact, some of them can be traced right back to the ancient world. In fact, to the time of the New Testament. And we'll touch on that thought as we conclude this evening. So, as I said, I'd like to just say a few things about the history of atheism to begin with. And then we'll move on and we'll talk about some of the writers who have been publishing against religion recently, particularly monotheists, the three monotheist religions, and of those, especially Christianity. And then we'll talk about some of their arguments and some of the stronger arguments and some of the arguments that don't work that well. This is a bust of Epicurus, who is one of the founders of ancient atomism. This is the belief that everything is based on atoms, and everything comes into existence through a kind of a random swerve of atoms and sort of chance conglomerations. The ancient atomists, who sometimes are referred to as the Epicureans, had this physical theory of the earth, that everything came about by chance, but they also had a metaphysical theory, and that is that the gods, if they existed, and there's some speculation over whether or not the Epicureans believed in the existence of the gods, and this would be a polytheistic pantheon. But if the gods existed, they don't have any control over the affairs of humanity, or indeed over the affairs of the natural world. So if they weren't philosophical atheists, they were certainly practical atheists. And so this is really the first kind of coherent atheistic system that we see in the ancient world, and dates back to the 300s and 400s BC. Now, the Epicureans were known not only for those teachings, but also for what is termed hedonism. Now, hedonism has several senses, obviously, today. It has a strong pejorative sense, as in, you know, just licentiousness and the pleasure principle and all that sort of stuff. But there's also a more moderate sense, and some people who are champions of Epicurean thought argue that it's really the more moderate sense that applies. And one aspect of that was just the pleasure of tending a garden. And as you can see, behind me, I have, well, you may not know that this is Athens, but you can certainly see a map behind me. And this is the city of Athens in the ancient world, so probably a few hundred years before the time of Christ. And this is Plato's Academy right here. That's Aristotle's Lyceum, and that's the center of the city with the agora, sort of the marketplace, and the stoa, or the colonnades, were where the Stoics met. That's where the term Stoic comes from. So here you see the gate around, the gate into the city and the wall around the city. And right here is the Epicurean Garden. So that's where the Epicureans met. The Platonists met here, the Stoics and the colonnades, the Aristotelians in the Lyceum. And this area right here is Mars Hill, well known to those who know the New Testament. So it gives you a sense of the topography of ancient Athens. Well, fast-forwarding to the 19th century, this chap behind me, some of you may recognize his visage, is Karl Marx, a very well-known atheist who developed a materialistic view of history. And Marx, as some of you may know, was Jewish, lived much of his adult life in England and railed against capitalism even while he was receiving handouts from Friedrich Engels, who was one of his collaborators and himself a capitalist. So he presented an atheistic view of history. This is Friedrich Nietzsche. He's the one who proclaimed at the end of the 19th century that God is dead. And he developed some ideas about a kind of an existential form of atheism. And what he wanted to argue is that since God is dead, we need to sort of exert our own human power. And he develops this notion of the Superman, that we should become these sort of heroic kinds of individuals. And sadly, some of his ideas, of course, are distorted and taken further later on by the Nazis, and he's not necessarily to blame for that, but that's something that happened with his thought. So he's the one who proclaimed God is dead. This person right here is Bertrand Russell. It's a caricature of Bertrand Russell, probably the most well-known atheist in the 20th century, certainly the first three quarters of the 20th century. He died at the age of 97. He almost made 98 in the year 1970. Bertrand Russell actually knew Christadelphians. In fact, in World War I, when he was interned because he was a CO, he met Christadelphians in the internment camps. And this is probably the source of the often quoted statement from Bertrand Russell that the Christadelphians are the best representatives of primitive Christianity, because he was exposed to Christadelphians who were his fellow COs, although, of course, Christadelphian position was based on a religious premise, whereas his was based on a secular one. Nevertheless, he wrote quite powerfully against religion. He wrote a book called Why I'm Not a Christian, and other works against religion. Another existential atheist is this chap right here, and I'm not sure why it is the case, but it seems that a lot of these chaps have some kind of tobacco sticking into their mouth. In any case, there you see Jean-Paul Sartre, who is a French intellectual, also an existential atheist, and very his writings are very well known. They're much studied in universities, etc. This person is Sigmund Freud, well known as the founder of psychoanalysis. And again, you'll see the tobacco in his hand there. And he was a well known atheist, also Jewish, and promoted atheistic ideas, which were taken up and advanced by some of his followers. Okay, now we've arrived at the present, the beginning of the 21st century. This is Richard Dawkins, easily the most well-known atheist intellectual alive today. And some people argue that he's kind of taken up the mantle of Bertrand Russell. The irony in using that expression, of course, is that that's a biblical expression. Nevertheless, there he is. He's a very good-looking man, very charming, has a very posh English accent, and is very compelling in his delivery. And he has published a number of works on science. One of them, which attacks the design argument, is The Blind Watchmaker. And the title of this book, I think, is self-evident, that the notion that there's a watchmaker who is an intelligent designer is something that he wants to counter, but he still wants to argue for design. He just says that it's something that comes about through physical and biological processes. So for him, there is a designer, there is design, let's say a design with a lowercase d, but the watchmaker is blind. Well, his most recent book is The God Delusion, and this is a book I'll refer to a few times in our presentation this evening. And this book came out in 2006, and it sold, I think, approaching 2 million copies. It's now in paperback, so one assumes that the copies will continue to sell as time goes on. And as you can see from the title, well, actually, you can't see it very well, the title of the book is actually very reflective, and I guess when I scanned it, it didn't turn out that well. It says the God delusion. You can see the word God there. And that's the one thing he wants to deny, and that's the only thing you can actually see. In any case, this is Daniel Dennett. He's a well-known biologist who has published a book recently called Breaking the Spell, and he wants to argue against religion as well, based on biology. This is Sam Harris, a little bit younger, doesn't have the gray hair of the other chaps. An American, I think he's just finished his PhD. While he was a graduate student, he published this book, The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason. Now, you can see a hint in the title of this book of one of the themes of these new works, and that is they're very concerned about radical fundamentalism, particularly when it manifests itself in acts of terrorism. And that's an important point that we have to bear in mind, that although they often speak in general terms, it's probably the case that one of their main targets, along with Christianity, would be fundamentalism that leads to terrorism, particularly of the Islamic variety. So that is hinted at in that title, but certainly many statements that these gentlemen have made indicates that that's one of their concerns. Now, as I'll emphasize a little bit later on, what they tend to do is they tend to conflate moderate, sort of reasonable, sensible expressions of religion with these kind of radical, destructive forms of religion. And, of course, this is something that moderate, sensible religious people object to. Again, the cigarette. This is Christopher Hitchens. He's a Brit, but he lives in the States, I believe in Washington, D.C. And interestingly enough, he has a brother who his name is Peter Hitchens, who's also very well known. And they differ on pretty much everything, including, I think, smoking. And Peter Hitchens is a theist and is conservative. This guy tends to be on the left, although he supported the invasion of Iraq, which has been a bit of an embarrassment to people like Dawkins. But nevertheless, this is the book that he has published, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Now, you'll see from the subtitle of this book that these proponents of atheism do like superlatives and hyperbole. How religion poisons everything. It's not really a reasonable statement to make, but of course it helps sell books. Okay, also in France, Michel Onfray published a book which has a different titles depending on which country it was published in. So The Atheist Manifesto, The Case Against Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. I think that's the American title. And the Canadian and the British title is In Defense of Atheism, same subtitle. And there's a long tradition of French atheism that goes right back to the 18th century, to the time of the Enlightenment. Okay, now I want to say a few things about what the new atheists get right. In their devastating critique of religion, including Christianity, they do score a number of valid points. Certainly, we've talked already about terrorism, particularly Islamic terrorism, and their argument is that there is an inextricable link between a particular form, at least, of Islam, a radical form of Islam, and these terrorist activities. And it's quite clear that link does exist. Now, of course, many more moderate Muslims would say that it's not coming out of true Islam, but it comes out of a radical variant that really doesn't represent mainstream Islam. So in any case, it is very, very clear that there are forms of religious fundamentalism and religious terrorism that are very, very dangerous. And we only have to think in terms of 9/11 and the possibility of small nuclear devices coming into the hands of these radicals, and it's a very worrying scenario. So radical religious terrorism, Islamic terrorism, etc., is unquestionably a great evil, and this is one of the targets of the new atheists. They point to things like sexual abuse in the church, not only, of course, the Catholic Church. It's a problem for virtually all churches. And in more general terms, religious hypocrisy. It's absolutely clear that religious hypocrisy does exist, and they point to this. And again, fundamentalism. They look at examples of very sort of unthinking fundamentalism, and they point out that this, in the hands of the wrong people, can be a very, very dangerous phenomenon. They also point to the intolerance of religiously monolithic societies. This is certainly a problem. I would like to point out as an aside, though, that there are problems with non-religious monolithic societies as well. One only has to think in terms of Stalinist Russia, Maoist China. And this relates to a broader critique that I would like to suggest, and that is that a lot of the problems that the new atheists are pointing to point more immediately to the human condition than they do to religion, politics, etc. We're all human, in other words. And something else that they point to are what they would refer to as kind of actually I'm not sure they would use the term unholy, but I'll use it, unholy unions between religions, particular kinds of religion, and political movements. One example that they talk about quite a bit, of course, is the United States, where evangelicals and others have aligned themselves with the Republicans. We heard on the radio on the way in that many Baptists in the United States are trying to sort of reclaim their faith, as it were, from those who are involved in politics. But there are examples in Europe, and obviously theocratic nations in the Islamic world, Saudi Arabia and Iran come to mind as well. So there are a lot of good points that the new atheists make. So it's not as if everything they say is wrong. It's certainly not the case that everything they say is wrong by virtue of their being atheists. I think we need to be charitable and exhibit some love in our interactions with those who take these positions. Now, one thing that's very important to emphasize is that one of the things that's fueling the new atheism is these kind of religious abuses that I have enumerated. It's very clear that one of the midwives, as it were, of the new atheist movement is corrupt and problematic forms of religion. And so that's a sobering thought, and it's something that everyone, including us in this room, need to take to heart. A related example of this is what happened in France in the 18th century. There was a very, very intolerant, monolithic, absolutist church in France in the 18th century, and this actually led to a very strong reaction against Christianity on the part of some of the French Enlightenment thinkers who moved all the way to atheism. That wasn't the only cause; there were other dynamics as well, but certainly that was one of the reasons. This, again, is a lesson that everyone, I think, in this room needs to take to heart. We have to ask ourselves, are we contributing to the bad reputation of Christianity, the bad reputation in some people's minds of the biblical message? Are we providing people with an excuse through our own actions and our speech and that sort of thing for abusing religion? Or are we doing the opposite, which is providing unbelievers with compelling reasons for faith and the religious life? At the same time, another comment that I think needs to be made at this point is that we can actually learn a lot from the criticisms of the new atheists. Many times, they're wrong, as I want to argue this evening. But in some cases, they do score some good points. So that is something else to keep in mind. Now, there have been the books that I've already mentioned, published by Dawkins, Hitchens, Harris, Dennett, and others. Predictably, there have also come many replies. I think probably this one's a little bit early. This was published in 2004. There are probably three or four books written against the New Atheists for every book written by one of the New Atheists. They're maybe not as high profile. They're maybe not selling as many copies, but they're certainly out there. So if you're looking for resources, if you're discussing atheism with a colleague or whatever, who is an atheist, the resources are definitely out there. Now, I'm not sure that I would have titled this book The Twilight of Atheism. It's sort of like creationist literature proclaiming on its title page, the end of evolution. And they've been saying that for years and years. It's very unwise to make those kind of predictions. Atheism has been around for a long time, and it's probably not going to collapse anytime in the future. In the U.S., about 10% of the population is atheist, and that number has remained pretty much stable for many, many years. So probably that's not going to change. And as a matter of fact, these recent books, because there are books written by atheists and books written by the counter-atheists, the religious people, probably we're not going to see a great movement from one to the other, because people are going to be able to go to the resources of their own point of view and find reinforcement. Nevertheless, the debates can be interesting. So the same chap that published the previous book, Alistair McGrath, with his wife, published this book, The Dawkins Delusion, which obviously is a takeoff from the title of the Dawkins book, The God Delusion, Atheist Fundamentalism and the Denial of the Divine. And this is one of the arguments that has been presented against people like Dawkins, particularly Dawkins, that he's kind of an inverse fundamentalist. He's kind of the mirror image of fundamentalism in many ways, or a kind of, in other words, he's kind of become what he hates, which is very, very ironic, because he tends to be very dogmatic and intolerant of religion and so on and so forth. And so he resists that critique, by the way, but it's made by a lot of people, including some of his fellow atheists. Now, Michael Ruse, who is a British come Canadian now American or Floridian philosopher, actually allowed something that he said to be put on the cover of the Dawkins Delusion. The God Delusion makes me embarrassed to be an atheist, and the McGraths show why. And this is because of the kind of inflexible, intolerant views that we see in Dawkins' book, but also the caricatures of Christianity in particular. And this is one of the problems with his argument, is that he's arguing often against a caricature of Christianity. And those who don't know much about Christianity will often take that as the gospel truth, when in fact it's a distortion. Another book, The Dawkins Letters, written by a Scottish clergyman who has actually engaged in dialogue with Dawkins. Okay, now, one of the big arguments that the New Atheists make is that there is all kinds of abuse of religion. Religion is used for all kinds of nasty things. Now, one of the important points, I think, to make about this is that often when these people are critiquing religion or Christianity, they're critiquing what I've just referred to as a caricature, a distortion of Christianity, a distortion of the Bible. I'll refer in a moment to one or two distorted interpretations of the Bible. And this, of course, makes their case a lot easier. If they can argue on the basis of a distortion, an unpleasant, an unsympathetic, an unfavorable presentation of Christianity, well, this makes their argument a lot easier. And so this is one of the first things that anyone in dialogue with someone who's taken on some of this literature needs to point out, is that often it's a straw man. what they're arguing against is a form of Christianity that a lot of Christians wouldn't even recognize. Now, of course, one of the problems that you often encounter with religious people of all stripes is dogmatism. And this Peanuts cartoon, most of you probably know that Charles M. Schulz was an evangelical Christian. I hear you're writing a book on theology, Charlie Brown says to Snoopy. I hope you have a good title. I have the perfect title. Has it ever occurred to you that you might be wrong? Now, this is clearly a problem. You do see rigid, intolerant dogmatism within religious circles. However, you also see it in political circles. You see it in philosophical circles. I could tell you some stories about philosophers that I know. And you find it amongst the atheists themselves. So again, this gets back to a point I made earlier, is that a lot of the problems that the atheists point to are really problems that relate to human nature and our selfishness and our arrogance, our hubris, etc. Okay. I alluded earlier to this kind of conflation between religious extremism, religious fanaticism, terrorism, and that sort of thing, and moderate religion. Now, for Dawkins in particular, but also some of the other new atheists, religion is fanaticism. There really is no strong distinction to be made, and people have pointed out to him, people who know him, people who have written against him, that this is a serious problem. It's unfair. It does a disservice to moderate religious folks. And at unguarded moments, Dawkins has acknowledged that, yes, there are moderate religious people. But nevertheless, if you read through his book, and if you read through the books of some of the other new atheists, this is one of the recurring themes. They qualify here and there, certainly. But this theme is a dominant one. Religion equals fanaticism. That's the core of what religion is. It's a form of fanaticism. Now, of course, there are all kinds of types of fanaticism, including non-religious types. But this is clearly one of the things they do. It's a rhetorical move in part. But I think also a lot of atheists who don't really know religious people that well really do believe this, that religion is fanaticism. So I think our job in many respects is to show that that is not the case. Now, another argument is the argument from atheism's definition of faith. And a definition that I've encountered a lot, this is not a straw man. I have had colleagues present this definition of faith to me. Faith is belief in the absence of evidence, by which they mean the complete absence of evidence. Now, if you think about this, It's pretty difficult to imagine any kind of faith that could be based on nothing. I mean, if you went up onto a hillside and dreamed up a religion, you still would be relying on categories that you've known since probably your youth. So it's a very weak argument, but it's also an argument that often is sincerely based on sincere positions about religious people, that faith isn't about evidence. It's not about evidence at all. And the counter-argument is that science is just about facts. It's fact-based, it's evidence-based, and so there's a contrast between science, which is fact-based, and religion, which isn't about facts. So this is a very, very common argument, but it is very, very problematic. Faith is unquestioning belief. This is another definition that I've encountered, and I've seen it in some of the books written by the new atheists. These are beliefs that are accepted, that are indoctrinated into children, and they're meant to be accepted without question. They're enforced by some kind of totalitarian religious system, etc., etc. Now, no doubt that examples like that do exist. There's no question about that. But nevertheless, this is kind of one of these kind of superficial definitions of faith that we find in the literature of the new atheists. Now, the definition of faith, I think, that we have in the Bible is different. Faith is belief in the absence of complete evidence. Now, I want to turn to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 is probably gives us probably one of the most well-known passages, if not the most well-known passage on faith. Hebrews 11, verse 1, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, for by it the elders, the Jewish elders, obtained a good report. Through faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. And then in verse 6, it says, but without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Now, if you were to read through Hebrews 11, this hall of faith, as it's sometimes referred to, you would see that these individuals were not basing their faith on the complete absence of evidence. They were basing their faith on incomplete evidence. Certainly they didn't see God. They didn't, they hadn't received their promises, but they had experiences which confirmed their faith. What faith is it's that thing which bridges the gap between the evidence that we do have, which is partial, and the rest of the evidence, which we don't have. It's outside of our grasp. That's what faith does. It's not blind faith with no evidence at all. It's evidence, faith, belief based on the absence of complete evidence. Now, the contrast with science, I've already referred to, it's a very, very common argument in the rhetoric of the new atheists that science is about facts and religion is not about facts at all. And a scientist who's also a theologian, Ian Barber, made this comment. Science is not as objective, nor religion as subjective, as has been claimed. So this kind of radical dualism between science based only on facts and religion not based on facts at all isn't borne out by the evidence. When you look at how religious people practice their faith, how they come to their faith, and when you look at the practice of science, you see that science is not just about facts, and it is based in part on subjectivities as well, including often incomplete evidence. In some forms of science, the evidence is not available at all. So you're in the realm of a theory. This quotation here, I think, brings out this point very well. The idea that scientific truth is arrived at without feeling or bias, based solely upon experimental data, has been shown to be a myth. The philosopher of science, Michael Polanyi, has shown that no truth is arrived at without the scientist assuming or having faith in a particular worldview, a kind of metaphysics. Accordingly, even in science, there is no such thing as abstract knowledge. It is always knowledge held by someone as commitment. So the faith component, so important in religion, has its counterpart in science. Now, the faith component in science is not the same. It's different in many respects, but there is overlap, right? So it may be wrong to use the term faith, apply it to science, but there is something that is kind of like faith. It's not religious faith, but it's a kind of faith, because often the scientist is basing his or her conclusions on a form of persuasion rather than deductive mathematical kinds of logic. Okay, now, I said earlier that faith is based on the absence of complete evidence. There are pieces of evidence that we use to base our faith on. They never go all the way, because if we had complete evidence, then obviously we wouldn't need faith. And Hebrews 11 verse 6 emphasizes that something that God requires of believers is faith. He needs us to go part of the distance. But nevertheless, there is evidence. It doesn't prove the existence of God, because in a mathematical sense, you can't prove the existence of God. It's a matter of faith. The evidence is not complete. Otherwise, it wouldn't require any moral contribution from us. It would be just a matter of doing a mathematical calculation. But here are a couple examples that have been in the news recently. An Austrian cuneiform expert was spending some time in the basement of the British Museum looking at cuneiform tablets, and I have a colleague who works on cuneiform, and he says that there are many of these tablets all over the world that haven't been translated. There are just so many of them, and there are not enough cuneiform experts. In any case, he came across a name that is found in the Bible, in Jeremiah chapter 39, Nebu Sarsakim, Sarsakim. And that was last year, I believe. There's a close-up of it. Another one which was in the news just last month is this tablet. It's actually a seal. It's called the Shlomit seal. And it's found in some excavations in the city of David, so just outside the walls of Jerusalem, by a an archaeologist named Eilat Mazar. And there are some, at least two names in the Bible that have these letters, Shlomit. There's a man with that name in Ezra, listed in Ezra 8, verse 10, amongst a list of exiles returning from Babylon. And also the daughter of Zerubbabel, mentioned in 1 Chronicles 3 and verse 19, is named Shelomit. So it's the same letters. It's interesting that you can see the high priests here with their beards and their robes. It's a very interesting insight into what they may have looked like. So this doesn't prove the existence of God, but it provides a form of a kind of coherence that the things that we read about in the Bible do have a historical basis. Now, another argument that you find amongst the new atheists is this argument from the worst possible case. And I want to refer particularly to interpretations of the Bible. I want to argue that Richard Dawkins and co. are very, very poor biblical exegetes. Now, it may be that sometimes the mistakes they made are sincere, but it also may be the case that they're arguing for the worst possible interpretation for purely rhetorical purposes. So, one argument that relates to this is the idea that when you see religious people or religious institutions committing acts of evil, it's probably because they're motivated by their religion. However, when atheists or atheistic institutions commit evil, they're motivated by other factors, not atheism, which is, I'm sure you'll agree, not a very fair way of going about the comparison. And the argument, and I've had this argument made to me a number of times, is that because atheists don't believe in an afterlife, they don't believe in a system of rewards and punishments, then they're not going to be motivated by their atheism. Well, I'm pretty sure that Stalin, during the Stalinistic purges, when he was killing many people, including Christians, I'm sure that atheism was part of the dynamic. Not all atheists do those sorts of things. And, of course, many religious people do nasty things. But nevertheless, the idea that somehow atheism doesn't motivate to do evil, whereas religion does, I think is not playing fair ball. Now, an argument that you will find in the God delusion is based on two incidents, one recorded in Genesis 19 and the other in Judges 19. And some of you may be familiar with these incidents. In the first incident, some angels go to Sodom and tell Lot and his family in Sodom that the city is going to be destroyed. And some men from the city come, and they tell Lot that they want to know the angels, and Lot, rather shockingly, offers his daughters instead. Now, this is seen as an example of normative morality in the Bible by Dawkins. Now, there are some serious problems with this. One of them is that the text has to be read in context, and it's quite clear when you look at what is said about Lot in these passages, he's presented as a morally weak man. What happens in the next chapter is just another example of that. There are also some other considerations that people are put forward, such as laws of hospitality and that sort of thing. Nevertheless, it's, I think, fairly clear that Lot is not presented as a kind of a paragon of morality in that particular passage. An even more difficult passage, I think, to read is the one in Judges 19, where you have a gang rape and the death of a woman who is gang raped. It's a very, very unpleasant text. And Dawkins, again, argues this is normative ancient Israelite morality. However, as people have pointed out, that text needs to be read in context. And the context, if you look at the surrounding passages, there's a recurring phrase that there was no king in Israel at that time, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. In other words, the text at the end of the book of Judges form an appendix that sort of tabulate incidents of moral anarchy. And the theme relates to not having a king. There's a moral breakdown. So the texts have to be read in that context. In other words, there is no condoning of rape. In fact, it's quite the other way. You see what happens afterwards. There's actually a big military conflict because people are so outraged at what happened. So that's an example of a distortion of the biblical text. The Bible describes the highs and lows of the human condition with frankness and honesty, but always within a moral framework. Now, another argument that someone presented to me, in fact, it was right after myself and someone else on an email list showed that you need to read Judges 19 in context. Someone sent a message out and said, well, yes, but how many people have died from picking up snakes after reading the conclusion of the book of Mark? So what I should have said was, okay, how many? Instead, I did the research, and it turns out that over the past 10 years, there's been two or three deaths from people picking up snakes. People do this in radical Pentecostal groups in the Appalachians and Kentucky, et cetera, et cetera. And occasionally, people do die. However, given the fact that there's almost 2 billion Christians on the earth, and that we're only dealing with two or three deaths in the past decade, surely the conclusion that one should draw is that the vast majority of Christians know how to read that text, realize that it has a particular context, that it relates to, if you read it very carefully, the disciples, probably only the disciples. And so really that kind of argument that the Bible sort of promotes, you know, snake handling and people doing these sort of dangerous things doesn't really work. Another argument is the argument from hell. And this is the argument that the Bible and Christianity in general teaches a very, very nasty doctrine, the doctrine of the eternity of hellfire torments. That is a very, very nasty doctrine. It is, when one contemplates it, it's a very horrible doctrine. And there are people who believe in it. There are people who believe perhaps some of us are going to be roasting in hell for eternity. However, it's not a biblical teaching. It doesn't come from the Bible. It's based on later ideas that are read into the biblical text. And so what I would say to Dawkins is go to hell. Go to hell and see what it looks like. And this is hell. This is Mount Zion. Actually, you're looking at Mount Zion. But right in front of the mountain, there's a valley there, and that's the valley of the son of Hinnom. In other words, Gehenna. The word for hell in modern Hebrew is Gehenna to this day. And you can see that there is a valley right there. This is the slope of Mount Zion, and the valley winds down to an Arab village at the bottom of the road. There you can see some Arab villagers having a picnic. And you can see there's a valley there. There it is again. And at the very top, there's an amphitheater there where they actually have rock concerts in hell, believe it or not. In any case, I don't know if you saw fire there, but there's no fire there at all. And the biblical teaching of Gehenna is based on the notion that there was a place of refuse, a garbage dump outside the walls, and they were kept burning to consume the rubbish, including the bodies of criminals. So when Jesus in the Gospels refers to Gehenna, he's referring to a kind of an object lesson that everyone at that time would know. I won't spend any more time on that because we need to move on, but this is a very, very common argument that in fact, Charles Darwin and several major thinkers used this teaching of hell as one of their reasons for breaking with Christianity. And it's an unnecessary reason. So it's very unfortunate that this idea is taught. The argument from evil is another example. Where does evil come from? This is not compatible with God. This is problematic for many reasons. One is if it's true that the existence of evil proves that there's no God, then does the existence of good prove that there is a God? I mean, the reasoning doesn't really work that well. Many point to examples of so-called natural evil, earthquakes, tsunamis. An example quite recently, of course, is the Indian Ocean tsunami, as natural events that are completely incompatible with a loving God. Well, this could be a topic on its own for another night, but there are lots of very good responses to this kind of an argument. And one of them comes from the chief rabbi of the UK, Jonathan Sacks, who right after the tsunami, just a few days after it, said that the reason why we have earthquakes and tsunamis is because we live in a physical world. God, by placing us in a physical world, set life within the perimeters of the physical. To wish it were otherwise is, in essence, to wish that we were not physical beings at all. Then we would not know pleasure, desire, achievement, freedom, vulnerability, and love. The religious question is, therefore, not why did this happen, but what then shall we do? Okay, another association that we see an association that we see the new atheists trying to promote is that atheism is inextricably connected with science. Science is the language of atheism, and so forth. However, what I want to argue is that what they refer to as science is really a form of scientism, and this is kind of the objectification or a kind of an idolatry of science, putting it on a pedestal and arguing not only that it's sort of infallible when it isn't, of course, but also that it is the normative way of knowing about the world. And this leads to a kind of fundamentalism. So just as some religions in history and today become arrogant, intolerant, abuses of power, and intellectually stagnant when they gain political dominance, so some advocates of scientism have grown arrogant, intolerant, and abusive of power, wishing to shut down the debate. And both these forms of fundamentalism oppose pluralism. So again, we come back to sort of human nature and the arrogance and the hubris that we see in human nature. So this is the argument that the new atheists want to present, that atheism is science, science is atheism. And they want to argue that because the majority of scientists, for example, in the U.S. are not theists, that there is a positive relationship between atheism and science. There clearly is a relationship between science and atheism, but it's a much more complicated one than that. Now, association with science is somewhat problematic, and one could kind of do a kind of a parody on this argument of atheists and argue that science is actually a really, really bad thing. Let me list you some examples. Environmental contaminants, petroleum economy, love canal, DDT, environmental illness, in medical science, prescription drug abuse, x-rays, CT scan cancer. CT scans are apparently cause cancer. Children of thalidomide, cell towers, cell phones, toxic waste, global warming and the environment, military science, the Gatling gun, flamethrowers, Nazi scientists, technological extermination, Zyklon B, Agent Orange, colorblindness, cluster bombs, nuclear weapons, the Manhattan Project, the Trinity test, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the A-bomb, the H-bomb, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Trident subs, intercontinental missiles, Dr. Strangelove, the day after, and nuclear winter. But that wouldn't be fair, would it? Because obviously science has these fallibilities, but it's done a lot of good things. Well, this is the same argument that is made against religion, because all those nasty things, religion's a terrible thing, so you throw it out. Look at what's happening in Kenya right now. There was an election, and there's a bloodbath. based not, by the way, on religion, but on ethnic divisions. Are the atheists calling for the abolition of democracy because in one case it's not working? No, that's not the conclusion that one should come to. So, with respect to scientists and religion, there have been some studies done recently, I've alluded to them already, in the States, which show that about 40%, fairly consistent over the years, of scientists in the States are religious. Now, for some people, that's a surprisingly high number. For some people, it's disappointingly low. It certainly is out of step with the wider population. One reason why this may be the case is because Christians are self-selecting and not going into science. And that clearly is a dynamic, although it hasn't been well studied. Nevertheless, this is used as fodder by the atheists. Now, the elite scientists are even less likely to believe in God, and I would argue this is something about intellectual elitism, at least in part, and the reasons for it are very complicated. But nevertheless, this is something that's used by atheists. Another study, which was broader base, showed that slightly more than half of scientists were religious, if one includes other religions as well. This compares with the global population. Something like 8% or so of the world's population are atheistic. This non-religious category here includes non-religious theists, so it's about 8%. So clearly, the proportion of scientists are religious is out of step with what's going on in the rest of the world. And that's something that needs to be considered, why that is the case. There's certainly a secularizing dynamic that happens in academia in general, but also, as I argued before, there is certainly some self-selecting going on, and maybe believers need to be more present in the sciences. Now, there are some scientists who are very well-known scientists who are religious. This is Francis Collins, the head of the Human Genome Project. He published this book, The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. A retired Harvard astronomer, Owen Gingrich, actually from a Mennonite background, wrote this book, God's Universe. It's a very short book based on some lectures, very easy read. So they do exist. Sadly, sometimes they have to wait until they retire before they publish these books so as not to create waves. Okay, we need to wind down now. I wanted to say a few things about atheism and morality. One of the common arguments used against atheism is that it's a recipe for immorality. It can be the case, but it's not necessarily the case for every individual. And we have to be careful here because you can find examples of atheists who never break the law and religious people who are in jail for murder and all those sorts of things. So we have to be careful there. But I think one of the problems with atheism is it doesn't provide a solid foundation, unshifting foundation for morality. Now, in Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, he talks about the new Ten Commandments of atheism. He got this off the internet. And I'll just read through these. Do not do to others what you would not want them to do to you. In all things, strive to cause no harm. Treat your fellow human beings, your fellow living things in the world in general with love, honesty, faithfulness, and respect. Do not overlook evil or shrink from administering justice, but always be ready to forgive wrongdoing freely, admitted and honestly regretted. Live life with a sense of joy and wonder. Always seek to be learning something new. Test all things. Always check your ideas against the facts and be ready to discard even a cherished belief if it does not conform to them. Never seek to censor or cut yourself off from dissent. Always respect the right of others to disagree with you. Form independent opinions on the basis of your own reason and experience. Do not allow yourself to be led blindly by others. Question everything. Now, I don't know about you, but when I read through that list, I had a vague sense, more than a vague sense, of familiarity. The first one is really just a reworking of the Golden Rule, which we find in the Bible, Matthew chapter 7, and verse 12. It's also in Luke chapter 6 and verse 31. And it also, number two there, in all things strive to cause no harm, is somewhat similar to the second of the two greatest commandments also found in the New Testament. Do not overlook evil or shrink from administering justice. This is very similar to the message about social justice that we have in the Hebrew prophets. Joy and wonder, we certainly find examples of that in the Bible. Test all things, this is very similar to the expression prove all things, which you find in the New Testament, and so on and so forth. I would argue that there are some problems with some of these ideas. For example, question everything. I mean, if you question everything, you would find yourself in a state of paralysis. So that's probably not wise, but certainly questioning certain things can be very, very useful. So the question that arises from reading these is, where are they getting these ideas from? Is there some kind of plagiarism going on? Because a lot of these ideas are very similar to ideas that are already existing in the Bible. And I look through Dawkins' text where he quotes this passage, and nowhere does he, that I could see, does he acknowledge the similarity between these ideas and New Testament ideas. There is clearly a developing moral vacuum in the secular world, and an article that I saw recently, which is quite interesting, is that higher divorce rates are causing problems with the environment, because what you're seeing is more and more people living apart in separate homes, burning more fuel and all that sort of stuff. And so there certainly are some moral problems in society. I don't need to remind you of them. They're everywhere. And the question I have is, what is atheism's solution to some of these problems? Again, I'm not saying that all atheists are hedonists or immoral necessarily, but I don't see a strong moral compass coming from atheism. Can atheists be 100% certain about their atheism? A definition that I read in the Encyclopedia Britannica is that atheists are absolutely certain that there is no God. I'm not aware that that's possible. I'm not aware that it's possible to be absolutely certain that there is God. And in fact, some atheists have been frank and admitted that there is, after all, the possibility of a God. E.O. Wilson, who I always thought was an atheist, a very well-known evolutionist, has argued that he tends toward deism, which is a form of theism. I'm just going to skip over this. I was going to show you a clip, but we need to finish now, so I'll just summarize it. Richard Dawkins, in a documentary, acknowledged that he would be happy to consider the possibility of a superintelligence who created everything and sort of set things going at the beginning. Interesting enough that this superintelligence is based on science, so he kind of creates God in the image of science, as it were. But even he, in an unguarded moment, more than once, I've seen this more than once, has acknowledged that it is possible that there is a God. And the interviewer who got that out of Dawkins said, well, if even Dawkins says that, then there's clearly some hope for theism yet. Belief versus unbelief, much more than intellectual matter. Another thought as we wind down is that these discussions that come from the atheists tend to center on science and sort of logical forms of argument, and there's a prioritizing of the discourse of science. And that's something that I think needs to be challenged. Science is very, very good at doing science. It's not very good at analyzing art or adjudicating moral issues, and it's certainly not very good at examining issues of faith. And some of the claims made about science is that it's omnicompetent. This is from the people who advocate scientism, not all scientists. And that is to say, science can do everything. So it becomes a kind of a god. And that rationalism is the best and ultimately the only credible way of knowing. That needs to be challenged as well. And also the dogmatic materialism. This isn't materialism in the sense of, you know, going shopping every weekend, but the idea that there is no spirit at all. Is that a reasonable position based on what we know about the universe around us? So I want to conclude with a reference to Mars Hill. I won't go there because we don't have the time, but Paul, when speaking on Mars Hill, and remember I showed you where Mars Hill was in Athens, found himself with an audience that consisted partly of Epicureans and Stoics. So he had these unbelieving sort of quasi-atheists in the audience. And what does he do? He points to nature. He points to the constancy of nature. He points to the providence of God. And he actually alludes to the Genesis account of creation, although he doesn't specifically mention that, but he uses language from the Genesis account of creation. There is what Mars Hill looks like today. It's not a very big hill. It's a little sort of a rocky outcropping. And that's where Paul was speaking with the Epicureans and the Stoics and the other philosophers. Interestingly enough, we're told that very few people responded to him. So the intellectuals found that these Hebraic ideas that he was presenting about the resurrection were very, very difficult to swallow. But there were some converts. So that's an interesting approach that one may want to take with an atheist, is to look at nature. What is nature telling us? Now, I'm not going to advocate the kind of the rational version of the design argument where you look at specific scientific arguments, because those tend to become obsolete, and that can be problematic as well. It's rather the stand back and say, wow, effect. And that's something that science, rational modes of inquiry can't touch. It's much more touchy-feely, but it's not necessarily wrong because of that. And this is, I think, what we get in the Bible, in the text that we had read at the beginning, Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. And we see this picked up in Jewish thought in the Middle Ages. A divine voice sings through all creation. A poem from the later Middle Ages, Abraham ibn Ezra, a Jewish interpreter of the Bible, wherever I turn my eyes around on earth or to the heavens, I see you in the field of stars. I see you in the yield of the land, in every breath and sound, a blade of grass, a simple flower, an echo of your holy name. Now, I use this because it's very similar to language that we find in the Bible. In fact, he's taking these ideas from the Bible. But this is not the language of science. It's not the language of rationalism with a capital R, but it's not wrong either. It's an authentic way of looking at the world. It's just different than science. And it's not wrong because it's different than science. It's complementary to it. And so when we look at, and here is a cross-section of a poppy bud, and we look at nature at the microcosmic level. This is a marine worm cross-section of a cedar leaf. This is quartz. And then we move to the macrocosm. We see beauty around us in the snowflake, the infinite variety of the snowflake, as you can see here. And, of course, to the heavens. And this is what the psalmist is speaking about, the beauty of the heavens, which provides testimony of a loving God. This is not a scientific way of looking at the heavens. It's more of a spiritual way with the eye of faith. And here you see some galaxies. And so the message that Paul gave to the Epicureans and others was the heavens declare the glory of God. Well, I've gone a little bit over time. I thank you for your patience.